Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 27th of June. Coming up on the program, will the voices of smaller parties be drowned out in a government of national unity? Tax rioting in Kenya, behind the bill that's been withdrawn, and now the road ahead. Two SANDF soldiers dead in the DRC, was it a case of poor training and planning? While the take-up of South African ID cards is so slow, and the encouraging story of a nuclear physicist and a decision to write children's science books. Well, the wait goes on, and let's start with politics and the impending cabinet announcement. Sometime this week, we are still hearing. And I want to give you a view today from one of the smaller parties, the Good Party, and its Secretary General Brett Herron joins us now. And he says his party has not made any demands for cabinet positions after joining the government of national unity. Brett Herron, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. Before we get to your party's strategy, what are you hearing today about a cabinet announcement from the president? The wait is interminable.
Hi, Jeremy. Look, the wait is to be expected. It's a very complex negotiating terrain that we're in. And the most recent thing that I've heard is that we can expect an announcement over the weekend. But that's anecdotal. It's not directly from any reliable source.
Brett, am I being a little disingenuous when in the headline to this program I said, is there a possibility of smaller parties such as yours simply being shut out of the process, your voice being drowned out because of the two big beasts in the room?
I think it is an unfair comment, or maybe it's unfair to preempt that. We have already seen that our voice was heard. We met with the ANC on the 9th of June. They presented the framework, the principles, and the minimum governing priorities. And we made some input as to what we would like to see included in the minimum government priorities, which includes a social safety net, addressing spatial inequalities. And the final draft of the document included what we asked for. So I think there is space for smaller parties to influence the program if they make sense.
But your work will only begin once there is finalization and consolidation, lest your ideas be put on the back burner. You're going to have to keep lobbying and lobbying very hard.
We will have to, and we have been lobbying over the last 5 years, for example, for a basic income grant, to the point where at the end of the term of office, the Minister for Social Development finally conceded, first of all, acknowledged our lobbying and said, in her mind, it's not a matter of whether we need a basic income grant anymore. It's a matter of how we implement it. So we lobbied as a two-seat party in the last term of office, and we will lobby for those issues that we got included in the statement of intent as the policy development process unfolds over the next 6 weeks.
Why did the Good Party decide to join?
Well, I think after the election was clear that, first of all, no party had an outright majority. The results could be analyzed as showing a nation that was increasingly polarizing around things that we wouldn't want to see going into a future South Africa, around race, around tribalism. And when the framework was presented to us by the ANC, the context, the founding principles, and the governing program priorities, and which we had influence over, there was no reason for us not to join, because we would like to see a united South Africa, and we want to contribute to that. And when the ANC included in the final draft the proposals that we made, there was really no reason not to participate in this nation-building project.
You've made it fairly clear that you haven't made any demands for a cabinet position, but there's a difference between demanding a cabinet position and expecting one, given that you have been there before with Patricia de Lille.
Well, we have no expectation. Patricia has packed up her ministerial house in Pretoria and her offices, and it's now the president's prerogative. If he wants to appoint Patricia back to the cabinet, the statement of intent sets out how that should happen in terms of consultation. But we have no expectation and we've made no demands.
Brett, do you think that this GNU, with so many parties being part of it now, there is a danger of it becoming too big and unwieldy? And as a result of that, there is the danger of inertia or simply policy deadlock?
I think that the inclusivity, the idea of including as many parties as possible in the context of trying to overcome a pattern that is developing, or what seemed to be developing in South Africa around polarization, makes sense. I think the bigger project of nation building and the potential that the government of national unity can have in building a country that finds each other across racial divides and lines outweighs the concerns that we have around inertia and slow government pace. I mean, government pace has been slow over the last 30 years. Mm. I can't imagine that it could be any slower.
Let's not put the cart before the horse, and this is a final question to you, but there is talk, there is whisper about this GNU perhaps becoming a more consolidated single party. Do you think there's any merit in that thinking, or is it simply wishful thinking?
I think it's wishful thinking. That there are obviously in the GNU parties who have signed the statement of intent, parties with different values and different policy positions, and we're all going to have to make compromises in those around our policy positions in order to finalize a government program, which is supposed to happen over the next 6 weeks. So it's unlikely, I think, that parties will merge into one unit when they have foundational differences. But we can overcome those foundational differences by agreeing on a program of government, but that doesn't mean that we become one party.
So, Brett, just very quickly, your sense is an announcement in the next couple of days. Do you think Jeremy Maggs will be working on Sunday?
I think you're going to be working very hard on Sunday. That's my guess, though.
All right, Brett Herron, thank you very much indeed. He is the Secretary General of the Good Party.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let's move further afield now, and the president of Kenya, William Ruto, says he will now not sign a controversial finance bill, bowing to pressure from protesters who've rocked the country over the past week or so. At last count, at least 13 people have been killed. Before we look at the bill itself and the aftermath of the protests themselves, this is what the president had to say.
Having reflected on the continuing conversation around the content of the Finance Bill 2024, and listening keenly to the people of Kenya, who have said loudly that they want nothing to do with this Finance Bill 2024, I concede, and therefore I will not sign.
Joining us on the program now is Wandiri Kamau, who's a journalist with the Africa Report in Nairobi. And Wandiri, first of all then, what is the position on the streets this afternoon? What are you hearing?
Most Kenyans is that there are mixed reactions, because, you know, the president yesterday said that they have dropped the bill. Yes, they have dropped the bill. So the resentment or the state of uncertainty is that yesterday he said that the government is going to adopt austerity measures to cover for the monies that would have been gotten through the taxes that were being proposed. But Kenyans, the state of uncertainty is, president said that he has withdrawn the bill, but the resentment is, or rather the state of uncertainty is, if a bill is approved by parliament and stays for 14 days without even the presidential assent, it automatically becomes a law. So what Kenyans are waiting is to see whether what measures, if the president will implement the measures that he said, if there will be another proposals. So that it's a matter of wait and see, because even the youth themselves who have been leading these demonstrations are in a state of wait and see. It's all a matter of waiting and seeing what next for the government. But the state on the ground is mixed reactions.
Could you explain to me how all of this played out yesterday, particularly why government saw it necessary to use such force to stop the protests?
There has been, from what I'm gathering, is that one side of the government, the president, because now is that there's a political crack between President William Ruto and Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua. One side of the government, especially the NIA side, which is Ruto leaning, because Noordin Haji, who is the deputy, the director of intelligence service, is a close ally of President William Ruto. The intelligence that is there, or rather the intelligence that had been gathered, according to Gachagua, who is the DP, is that there was a plan to craft propaganda that he, among other leaders, among them retired President Uhuru Kenyatta, are the one that are financing these protests. And so, in fact, he never attended the press conference that President Ruto had been accompanied, the State House conference, but that he had been accompanied by the UDA MPs announcing the withdrawal of the bill. Instead, he held his own conference in Mombasa. So there has been blame games between Ruto's faction and Gachagua's faction, because the Ruto faction has been alleging that Gachagua and his allies are financing these protests. So that's why the president had to use a lot of force, or rather the security agencies had to use a lot of force, because the perception was that they are querying these. And actually, even Ruto, in his Tuesday night speech, alleged that there were financiers and orchestrators of this violence, and actually the security agencies would deal with the protesters and the financiers decisively. So it's that perception that there's a hand that is financing this protest. That's why the government had to use a lot of force to quell them.
And where does this leave President Ruto politically right now? How compromised is he, do you think?
This one surely leaves President Ruto in a very precarious position politically, because these cracks have actually exposed him. And with Gachagua's allegations that the NIS is a shell of its former self, then it means that, and actually he said that the president is exposed security-wise and politically. But political speaking is that there has been rumors that Gachagua is gravitating towards the opposition. Last Sunday, Gachagua and Kalonzo Musyoka, who is one of the key political principals of the opposition's Azimio la Umoja coalition, attended a function on Friday. And Kalonzo said that because there has been some of the President Ruto's allies have been calling for the impeachment of Gachagua. In that faction where they attended together with Kalonzo Musyoka, Kalonzo Musyoka said that the opposition is ready to defend Gachagua on any plans to impeach him. Still on that function, Gachagua has been calling for the unity, has been rallying his Kikuyu community, which comes from central Kenya, to politically unite. Gachagua also urged Kalonzo to unite his Kamba community, which is the Kikuyu and Kambas are political cousins. There's a movement called the Gema community, which includes the Kikuyus, Embus, Merus, and the Kambas. And you find that the Kambas are political cousins of the Kikuyus. And so Gachagua also urged Kalonzo to start initiatives or, you know, efforts to unite his Kamba community. And so this now politically really exposes President William Ruto, because even these protests were even witnessed in his own backyard, in Rift Valley's counties like Uasin Gishu, Kericho, Bomet, where he comes from. And also they were witnessed in Gachagua's home turf of Nyeri and Nyandaro, which are in central Kenya, which is Gachagua's home turf. So this one has politically exposed, really exposed President William Ruto politically. And, you know, and there are talks that he may be a one-term president if he doesn't employ measures to reach for more political allies ahead of 2027 general elections.
Speaking to me from Nairobi, that's Wandiri Kamau, journalist with the Africa Report. Wandiri, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, now let me move 1,200 kilometers to the west of Nairobi, and M23 rebels attacking the town of Sake in the Democratic Republic of Congo has seen the deaths of two South African National Defence Force soldiers. 20 more, I understand, have been injured. Those figures might have changed, though. In conversation with Advocate Pikki Grieff, who is from the South African National Defence Union. Pikki, welcome and thank you very much for talking to us today. What are you hearing about how this attack happened? And maybe you could also explain to us the exact nature of this deployment.
Thank you for having me, Stephen. Firstly, let's start with the nature of the deployment. These SADC forces were sent in there with a specific mandate, which was to pursue aggressively the M23 rebels. That would mean that they would at some or other time have to engage in combat operations. So that's firstly. And secondly, what we hear about yesterday or the day before's attack is that there were two instances of mortar attacks from the rebel side on South African positions. And that directly led to the death of two soldiers and the injury of 20 or so of our members of the SNDF.
Pikki, is this just battlefield tragedy, or should there have been more specific measures taken to improve perhaps readiness and position?
Well, from the union's point of view, obviously this is an operational issue and one accepts that there can be casualties and injuries during combat operations. But having said that, and we by no means saying we know exactly what went wrong or if anything went wrong and whether it's simply a battleground tragedy, but it is common knowledge. And we've been saying it over and over again that our troops lack adequate air support, both in combat, the combat sense, in logistical sense, and in the medical evacuation sense. We need that air support. We have no air support at this stage. Some of the radar systems that we need to defend ourselves against incoming artillery or at least mortar, that is also apparently not yet operational, which one would have wanted to see from the very start. And, those are things that one has to question. Because they're not in place, could this have been prevented? That is a very valid question to ask.
Are there protocols in place now, given what you've just told me, to ensure the swift and safe evacuation of those injured?
Well, we don't know. What the information we have from the ground is that there is no such adequate support. The support is inadequate. We have reports that one of the officers who were wounded, quite a senior officer at that, had to wait hours to be evacuated to a medical facility. That's completely unacceptable. If we're going to commit our troops to these kinds of combat operations, which is exactly what they are, then we will have to provide them with the necessary equipment and resources to act like and be treated as professional soldiers.
And I understand the pressure in that respect is very important, but difficult for the SANDF to act on that pressure given its well-ventilated budget issues.
Well, that's the whole point. The problem here is not the SNDF. It's not the SNDF command structure. The problem here is finances. And really, it's time we are of the view that it's time that the commander-in-chief of the SNDF, which is the president of this country, should step in. Treasury should step in. As far as we're concerned from the union side, this is a crisis for South Africa, and we need to protect our soldiers, and we need to have an adequate response when our soldiers come under attack.
I understand that there is an African Union mandate here, but given the constraints that you've just outlined for me, should we be in places like the DRC in the first place then?
That's not for the union to have an opinion on that. We serve the members and their interests in the workplace and in their roles as soldiers. Decisions about deployments, whether they're wise or not, that is not something we're going to comment on.
All right, then I will ask you whether there are enough support systems in place to help the families of those fallen and injured.
I believe, from that aspect, there is enough support systems in place. But one would want to prevent those incidents as far as one can. And if you have adequate protection, you'd hopefully not need to rely on those support services. But they are in place.
Advocate Pikki Grieff, thank you very much indeed from the South African National Defence Union.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Department of Home Affairs says that the old green ID books in South Africa are on their way out and it will declare them invalid. And here's the interesting timeline, very soon. Well, what does that mean? Joining us now is Thulani Mavuso, Deputy Director General, Home Affairs. And first of all, Deputy Director General, is this true about the withdrawal? And what does very soon actually mean?
No, thank you very much. And thanks to the listeners. So what we have done is that when we started issuing the smart ID cards, the target was to replace 38 million green ID books. Where we are today is that we have just issued over 25.9 million smart ID cards. So we're still a little bit far away from replacing all the green ID books, because every year we issue 3 million. And you will know that there are also those who turn 16 we have never had. So those are new issuance and the reissues. So we are not about to actually invalidate the green ID books. They still continue to be a legal document. That decision has not been made by the department. So what is making rounds in the social media is actually not the truth. There's still a few more years before we will be able to do that. Part of the problem is that we had not an adequate footprint to ensure that we cover all South Africans who need the smart ID card. So what we have taken a decision through the minister that we are now increasing our mobile trucks, which are able to do smart cards. We added about 100 on the 7th of May. So we're now sitting at about 227 mobile offices that can go to far-flung rural areas.
Given that we've had smart cards or ID cards for a decade now, why has that footprint been so narrow? It seemed to me the department has been very slow, been very tardy in responding to that need.
No, I don't think it's about department being tardy or slow. Basically, it boils down to resources. I mean, the financial constraints around us modernizing our offices, but also some of the offices we are not able to modernize them because where they are located, we don't have adequate coverage in terms of the bandwidth that we need. Because an office to be a smart card office, at least at the minimum, you need a 5 meg bandwidth. Some offices in rural areas are not able to have that, basically because telcos or telecommunication companies are not investing enough in those areas. Because normally, where they put like towers and other infrastructure, they need to be able to recoup their investment. But if it's in an area where really they are not able to get that back to them, that's why some of the areas we find that they don't have 5G or 4G. So we can, for example, use the LTE routers in those areas. So that's one of the challenges. That's why we also were looking at utilizing satellite connectivity to be able to improve and increase the footprint. So that's the challenge around that particular issue. But the mobile trucks are helping us to cover those areas.
But effectively, what you're saying is that you are held hostage by the telcos until they start to improve their coverage.
In rural areas, that's the point. In rural areas, but in modern, in urban areas, we don't have that particular problem. But also, there's not only the only factor. The other factor is that even ourselves, if you look at the budget allocation that we receive, I mean, we receive about 10 billion rand in terms of the budget on an annual basis. About almost 4 billion rand of that goes to compensation of employees, because we've got just over 7,500 employees. But part of that also is an allocation for the IEC political party funding. They come from the vote of allocated Home Affairs. So if you drill down on terms of operational budget and our ability to expand, it's actually very little when you look at the size of the population we serve, because Home Affairs is the only department in the country that every citizen is a client, and that you get visited more than two or three times by citizens on an annual basis for different services. So if you multiply that, and also the foreign nationals that are coming through our borders. So there's a whole lot of host of factors that constrain us to be able to increase our footprint in the manner that we desire. But we are obviously making efforts with the allocation that we have.
One of the other criticisms about the slow uptake of smart ID cards are setbacks within Home Affairs' purview in finalizing agreements with banks to offer smart ID enrollments and collections. Is that true?
Well, it's not a delay. Fortunately, I am the one heading that particular project, so I can be able to just give a sense. So what we did is, when we started this project in 2015, this pilot project, we wanted to sign an agreement with all the banks through the Banking Association of South Africa. National Treasury indicated to us that we can't do that. We'll have to do a triple P agreement. So we went through a triple agreement process, which is a very long one. You have to get a transaction advisor, develop a business case, and so forth. So it went a long route up until National Treasury gave us now the go-ahead to be able to enter into partnership agreements with the banks. Those partnership agreements have been prepared. Actually, the last meeting we had about 2 weeks ago, the legal teams were still finalizing that. So we're expecting that the agreement with the banks will be signed so that we can increase the footprint. Mm. Because with the banks, give or take, we're looking at getting at least about 200 more sites to be able to increase our footprint. So that's the bigger issue, that when a private partner deals with a government or offer a public service, there's got to be a clear legal processes that is followed so that we are able to ensure that all the activities that are undertaken, they are in line with the legislation.
There's another potential problem that's been flagged, and that's beneficiaries of the Social Relief of Distress Grant who may be unable to complete the new identity verification process if they still have a green ID book. Can you throw some light on that for me, please?
No, that's not true. Everybody who's got a legal an ID document, be it a smart card or a green ID book, all of those, they are verifiable through their biometrics. So in other words, we've got two databases now, which is the HANES system and the ABIS. Both of them carry the database of citizens. So we are able to do biometric verification. So even those ones, they are on the database. If you are green ID book, if you go to the bank, they're still able to verify you through your fingerprints.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Tulani Mavuso, Deputy Director General, Department of Home Affairs, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally, let me leave you with a little inspiration. The University of Pretoria's Dr. Tabasile Tabete is a nuclear physicist, but a strong motivation as well to help younger students. And to that end, she's also found time to write books on science and maths for youngsters. She joins me on the program now. And Dr. Tabete, first of all, given your busy schedule, what inspired you then to start writing for this young audience?
What really inspired me is more like my daughter, because it was like, you know, every time when I'm working and she would want to play with me. So I had to try to figure out a way of trying to do my work, but also at the same time incorporate her in what I was doing. And also I kind of figured that throughout my whole entire life to get to where I was, I found that there were so many things which I found that were difficult. But if things were done slightly differently, it would have been a bit easier to reach where I am now. So for me, introducing something like your science in a slightly younger age and in a way that it is more experimental, fun, adventurous for kids, it will be something that at some point it will close the gap, and it will also reduce the fear of people wanting to occupy spaces in the science field.
Could you describe for me, Doctor, the process then of simplifying what I assume are complex scientific concepts for younger children? You've got to speak in a different language and I guess a completely different tone.
Yes. So basically with kids, it's more like using what is around us. For example, if we're going to speak about the different phases of matter, your solid, liquid and a gas. That is, if you think about in terms of water, you have water, which is in liquid phase. You've got gas, which is in when you're boiling your water, when you see your steam, and then eventually you've got your ice. Then if you've got your thermometer and then you can actually boil the water with your child and then you tell them, look at what is happening. Can you see now that it's changing? That's what we refer to as solid. Or you can think about sound, teaching a child about sound. There are different types of sounds that you have or that you can hear. You can use your clock, you can use music. Mostly what I'm referring to is using our daily life experience to actually engage them, to actually see the relevance of science and also finding it fun.
Dr. Tabete, you spoke a little earlier about the fear that goes with a process like this. Why do you think there is fear around STEM subjects in South Africa?
Sometimes you think that something is difficult, and you hear a lot of people around you saying that something is difficult. Doing something that is difficult, by default, you're going to have fear. Because you already know that, look, everybody's saying it's tough. And you feel like, how will I be able to do it? So one of the things that one can change the narrative, help people around us to not necessarily always have negative comments about the science, it will also be helpful. And also getting everybody to be involved in the whole science thing. For me, I think it will go a long way. If you look at your platforms like your Netflix, your Disney, they've now included series which includes some of the science activities which are fun, which anyone can do at home, including the parents can watch with their kids, which I feel it's something that we need.
What do you hope the children then will take away from the books, and how do you look at these early lessons impacting their future interest in science? Do you think you will take away that fear quotient?
It will spark the interest. It will spark the interest and the idea of that something is hard. It'll be, yes, it might be hard, but I can do it. You know, if you think about kids, kids are curious. They're always asking questions, although sometimes they'll tell them, oh, I'm busy. But if you can like kind of like entertain them, when you give them something to do and they read about it, then they don't fear that it's hard. They are willing to learn at that point. And if we can actually take that advantage and actually encourage them to continue with that attitude up until they reach a certain age, I feel like we would have basically not necessarily completely removed it, but reduced the fear. And also they will gain confidence in terms of doing physics or chemistry, biology, and all the other science subjects. So yes, and there will also be some sort of background that you have, the foundation will be there.
And Dr. Tabeti, let me finish with this, if I can. Your own journey is an interesting one, and your transition from what you were doing to nuclear physics to doing the books right now. How important is it, do you think, for students to remain open to different fields of study all the time during an academic journey?
It is actually quite important. One of the reasons why I would say that is important is, one thing is that there is a link between most of the subjects. And then when you see that there's a link, you need to know that if I am doing physics or I'm doing chemistry, I can always be able to actually work as part of chemistry or other things. So it is important to keep an open mind because there are many opportunities in different fields. And if you are able to actually learn certain things, you are able to transition from one form to another, or should I say from one topic of study to another. So yes, the journey is not always straightforward. You might not be able to get what you want, but you've got the knowledge, the skills, so you should be able to transition to another path, yes.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. As you say, the journey is not always straightforward, but it's got to be interesting, and I guess you've got to change it all the time. A very inspiring story, Dr. Tabasile Tabete from the University of Pretoria. Thank you so much for joining me today. And before we leave, our last online poll, we spoke about Rand Water's big ongoing fix, and I asked if you were confident, if it's too late, or if your glass was half full, and an equal degree of confidence and wait and see expressed by our respondents. And thanks so much to all of you who participated. Today, we reflected earlier on South Africa's ID cards. Do you still have a green book? You have an ID card, or are you worried about the switch? If you have a view on that, please participate either on our X or LinkedIn pages. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.